With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Come to the place where we meet to talk about wild creatures such as science, art, music, the humanities, technology, humor, and all things geek.
Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey, very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think? Code Monkey think maybe manager wanna write goddamn login page himself. Code Monkey not saying out loud. Code Monkey not crazy, just proud. Code Monkey like Beatles. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man, a big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey hang around at front desk till your sweater look nice. Code Monkey offer buy you soda, bring you cup, bring you ice. You say no thank you for the soda, cause soda make you fat. Anyway, you busy with the telephone, no time for chat. Code Monkey have long walk back to cubicle. He sit down, pretend to work. Code Monkey not thinking so straight. Code Monkey not feeling so great. Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man, a big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey have every reason to get out this place. Code Monkey just keep on working, see your soft pretty face. Much rather wake up, eat a coffee cake, take bath, take nap. This job fulfilling in creative way, such a load of crap. Code Monkey thinks someday he'd have everything, even pretty girl like you. Code Monkey just waiting for now. Code Monkey says someday, somehow. Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey very simple man, big warm fuzzy secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you.
Everyone else is having fun, or else pretending to.
As always, there are items of interest in the news, and we have the Higgs boson, our moon, bugs and bees, vaccines, animals, a couple of tech stories, and a guy that got pelted by aliens today. Well, teams of physicists are closing in on what has been called the God particle. 1,000 physicists working at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois, reported in Paris on Monday that they had not found the quote-unquote God particle quite yet, but they are beginning to figure out where it is not. Its mass, in the units preferred by physicists, is not in the range between 158 billion and 175 billion electron volts, according to a talk by Ben Kilminster at Fermilab at the International Conference on High Energy Physics in Paris. And so, the most intensive particle hunt in the history of physics goes on. Over the last decade, physicists working on two separate experiments at Fermilab have combed the debris from 1,000 trillion, that would be 1 with 15 zeros after it, collisions of protons and antiprotons, looking for signs of the Higgs boson, which is said to be responsible for imbuing some other elementary particles with mass. Rumors fanned by a blogger that the Higgs, dubbed the God particle by former Fermilab director Leon Lederman in a book of the same name, had been detected, reached all the way to Gawker last week, and focused attention on the Paris conference, which also featured a speech by President Nicolas Sarkozy of France. The new results, combining the data from two separate Fermi experiments, D0 and CDF, narrow the range in which the Higgs, if it exists, must be hiding. Physicists had previously concluded that it must lie somewhere between 115 billion and 200 billion electron volts. By comparison, a proton, the anchor of ordinary matter, weighs in at about a billion electron volts. A new competitor is about to enter the hunt, though. Physicists from CERN's Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, the most powerful accelerator in the world, announced their machine, which started operating at half power in March, with 3.5 trillion electron volt protons, had rediscovered all of particle physics, most recently the top quark. And thus the table was set for it to begin to look for new physics as well as the Higgs. The new collider has registered about 1.5 billion collisions, but with more energy at its disposal, it hopes to catch up to Fermilab in a year or so. Ooh, here's something cool. The Apollo 11 moon landing video has been restored with sound. On July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong as well as Buzz Aldrin landed upon our moon. Not only were they filmed by two different camera angles, but the film never had a synchronized soundtrack. But for the 40th anniversary of the moon landing, Footage Vault, which sourced and supplied the archive material for the award-winning documentary film In the Shadow of the Moon, started this process with the film's editor, David Fairbank, back in 2006. But they had only attempted to lip-sync a few seconds of footage at that time. It's now been finished with audio and is being released. Now filmmaker and Apollo aficionado Stephen Slater, working with the London-based Archive Film Company, has painstakingly united the visual material with high-quality recordings of the original mission audio. Slater has taken it to a new level, synchronizing more than 8 minutes of the Apollo 11 landing. Some of this footage has become almost as iconic as the shots of Saturn V launching or the Earth rising over the moon, says Slater. But as a filmmaker, I was always rather disappointed with the way mission control shots were used in such a generic fashion, without any sense that it was the actual moment that the Eagle had landed. Now, you can see the video at www.footagevault.com. and search Apollo 11 for the four-screen synchronized footage, or you can see the original footage with no sound at nasa.gov. And now back on Earth, we have news from south of the border, way south of the border. A Mayan royal tomb filled with offerings that include the bones of children has emerged from an archaeological site in Guatemala. An international team led by Brown University's Stephen Houston reported the discovery unearthed from the El Diablo Pyramid in the city of El Zotz in May. Dating to 350 to 400 AD, the burial chamber, some 6 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 12 feet long, lay under a small temple to a sun god at the foot of the pyramid. When we opened the tomb, I poked my head in, and there was still, to my astonishment, a smell of putrefaction and a chill that went to my bones, Houston said in a statement. The chamber had been so well sealed for over 1,600 years that no air and little water had entered. Looking into the tomb for the first time, archaeologists saw, quote, an explosion of color in all directions. Reds, greens, yellows. These items are artistic riches extraordinarily preserved from a key time in Maya history. The tomb contains carved wood, painted stucco, rope, and pottery, as well as bowls containing finger bones. Quote, so far it seems likely that there are 6 children in the tomb, some with whole bodies and probably 2 solely with skulls, says the statement. We still have a great deal of work to do, Houston said. Royal tombs are hugely dense with information and require years of study to understand. No other deposits come close. They have released pictures of the antiquities and are yours for the Google price of free on several news sites if you'd like to take a look at the new discoveries yourself.
I'm not the one who's so far away when I feel the snake bite enter my veins. Never did I wanna be here again, and I don't remember why I came.
Wow, some exciting news over the last couple of weeks in the world of health. A new gel decreases the risk of HIV in South African women. Scientists from Columbia University have just developed a gel that is aimed at helping women protect themselves against HIV. In sub-Saharan Africa, women and girls account for about 60% of HIV infections. Currently, these victims have no way to protect themselves against HIV if their male partners refuse to use condoms. Researchers have been working for over a decade to create a topical gel that women can use vaginally to prevent infection, but none has proven successful until now. At the International AIDS Conference in Vienna, researchers have reported that this new vaginal gel had reduced a woman's risk of acquiring HIV by up to half. Researchers recruited 889 sexually active women between the ages of 18 and 40 in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. This gel contains the HIV drug called tenofovir. Tenofovir is already used in pill form because it helps slow HIV spread through a patient's body. They used the treated gel before and after relations. Those who used it had a drop of 39% compared to the placebo gel, and women who used it frequently had a reduction of 54%. This study is a major advance in HIV prevention, since it's the first to demonstrate a vaginal gel can safely block the AIDS virus. Scientists are encouraged with this, even though it is only partial protection. This is the only success in the battle of HIV prevention seen in recent years. Researchers also added that the gel is years away from mass production. Further trials, of course, will have to confirm the gel's efficacy and safety. The current study can be found published online July 19th by Science. Hey, vaccination patches could make immunizations ouchless. Most people freak out at the thought of getting a shot. Why? Because of the fear of the needle. But now, a new invention will replace that big scary needle with a patch studded with 100 tiny dissolvable needles. This new patch was used with mice vaccinated against influenza and was just as effective as the hypodermic method. Sean Sullivan, the lead scientist in the study at Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, says it's like a sticky band-aid coated with 100 microneedles that are shorter than the thickness of a nickel. The microneedles pierce the skin and dissolve into the surrounding bodily fluid, which releases the vaccine into the body, taking anywhere from 30 seconds to 5 minutes. This patch is so easy to apply and can be stored at room temperature, special medical training isn't required. People would be able to pick up the patches from the pharmacy or the mail and vaccinate themselves. The researchers also state that the patch could be used for many of the needle vaccinations, such as the annual flu shot. Of course, human studies will have to be done because these studies were carried out using mice. The hope is that this method will actually be more effective at generating immune response than traditional shots. The vaccine has to go from the muscle to the blood and lymph system and then to find the cells to instigate protection. But this microneedle patch goes right into the skin already ripe with immune cells. Several studies have been shown that skin-based delivery of vaccines is more effective than intramuscular injections. So, a better response may also indicate lower doses of vaccine that has to be administered as well. Physician Wilbur Chen of the Center for Vaccine Development at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore says that the new patch, quote, might prove a powerful public health tool, unquote, and that the patch will be helpful in developing countries where electricity to keep liquid vaccines cold is in short supply, and the needles and trained medical personnel are also hard to come by. Studies will need to be conducted to see how long the patches can sit at room temperature, but Sullivan predicts that they would be stable in the order of months. So it looks like the cost is also projected to be about the same as the other method, but that the technology is ready for clinical trials within the next couple of years. You can find the report in the online issue from July 18th in Nature Medicine. Did you know that malaria kills nearly 1 million people a year? Researchers have long sought an end to this disease, and now it looks like they've hit their target with malaria-proof mosquitoes through gene modification. The parasite that causes malaria is not able to infect the genetically modified insects, which is a huge step in eradicating the infection. And as we all know, mosquitoes are the vector that spreads the disease to us. These genetically modified mosquitoes are not ready for the outdoors just yet, but the researchers have achieved a 100% blockage of the Plasmodium parasite, which is a major stride in the ongoing malaria war. Entomologist Michael Ryle at the University of Arizona created the mosquitoes by altering just one gene involved with insulin production. They then injected 90 of the mosquitoes with the malaria parasite, and 10 days later, boom, when the normal mosquitoes would have stomachs full of Plasmodium parasites, there weren't any. This was the first time a genetic modification has completely blocked development of a malaria parasite that can infect humans, which is biologically urgent in this battle. Other researchers have achieved 90 to 95% blockage by combining various genetic alterations, but such less than perfect protection could allow the parasite to evolve around the mosquito's blocking mechanism in much the same way that drug-resistant bacteria can arise if antibiotic treatments aren't completed. The signaling processes that affect the mosquito's lifespan as well as its immune response was the bullseye of that project. By getting the lifespan decreased by 20%, the mosquitoes die young. The Plasmodium parasite would not live the 16 days that it needed to mature on the host. The complete blockage of the parasite development was an unexpected bonus. The researchers don't yet understand how the genetic change makes the mosquitoes malaria-proof. We were just hoping to see any reduction, Ryle said. We were pretty shocked that it was that great. In spite of this genetic engineering success, there are two main hurdles before such mosquitoes could be used to reduce malaria infections. First, the modified gene would have to spread throughout the entire mosquito population. Ordinarily, this would happen only if the gene provided a great evolutionary advantage. But these malaria-resistant genes just don't have that effect. A big consideration in the releasing of an engineered flying insect into the environment could prove damaging to other plants and animals. So before the researchers could undertake any field trials, they would need to do extensive safety testing. Ryle suspects that, in time, researchers will perfect their ability to effectively use genetically modified mosquitoes, and that governments and public health organizations will work together to deploy them. However, experts agree that such an approach is at least 10 years away, if not 20 or more. One important part of the malaria fighting effort is vaccines, a two-way approach that targets both disease-transmitting mosquitoes, such as these with genetic engineering, and susceptible human populations, most likely with vaccines, will probably be required for eventual eradication of the disease. We definitely don't imagine this to be the magic bullet, Ryle said about his mosquito. But it's another tool in the toolbox. The research was reported online this week in the journal PLOS Pathogens.
When you were before, couldn't look you in the eye. Just like an angel, skin makes me cry. You float like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so very special. But I'm a creep. I'm a widow. What the hell am I doing here? I don't belong here. I don't care if it hurts. I wanna have control. Perfect body. I want a perfect soul. I want you to notice wish I was special, but I'm a creep. I'm a winner. What the hell am I doing here?
Technology in the news. Egyptian impact crater first spotted on Google Earth. Researchers poring over Google Earth images have discovered one of Earth's freshest impact craters, a 45-meter-wide pock in southwestern Egypt that was probably excavated by a fast-moving iron meteorite no more than a few thousand years ago. Although the crater was first noticed in autumn 2008, researchers have since spotted the blemish on satellite images taken as far back as 1972, says Luigi Falco. Now, he's a cosmochemist at the University of Siena in Italy, and he and his colleagues reported this finding online in the issue of July 22nd in Science. The rim of the Egyptian crater stands about 3 meters above the surrounding plain, which is partially covered with distinct swaths of light-colored material blasted from the crater by the impact. These rays, which emanate from the impact site like spokes from the hub of a wheel, are what drew the researchers' attention to the crater, says Falco. While such rayed craters are common on the Moon and other airless bodies of the solar system, they are exceedingly rare here on Earth because erosion and other geological processes quickly erase and erode such evidence. During expeditions to the site, early in 2009 and again this year, scientists found more than 5,000 iron meteorites that together weigh more than 1.7 tons. The team estimates that the original lump of iron weighed between 5 and 10 metric tons when it slammed into the ground at a speed of around 3.5 kilometers per second, with most of the material vaporizing during the collision. Analysis of soil samples from the site and of sand fused into glass by the impact's intense heat and pressure may help the team estimate when the event occurred. Preliminary analysis suggests that when it happened, it was sometime during the last 10,000 years, but probably no more than 5,000 years ago, Falco says. Interesting. Online social sites. You talk to people all the time online. Do you know them? How well do you know the people on your friends list? Here's a story from TechEye.net that's going to make you think about things maybe a little bit differently. A murderer was caught through his Facebook profile. Probably not the wisest move to be Facebook friends of the victim's family. A murderer has been caught after his Facebook account gave him away. 28-year-old Mark Dyson, a computer technician who probably should have known better, was wanted for the robbery and murder of 9 people in the Philippines. Police had been hunting for him since July 12th when the first murder began, but were unsuccessful until his Facebook page became involved. Dyson is accused of killing a Canadian and his Filipino girlfriend on July 12th, then a Briton and his girlfriend on July 16th. It was the last set of murders that would lead to his arrest, however. After killing American 70-year-old Albert Mitchell and his 53-year-old wife Janet and three Filipino staff working at their home last week, a friend of the family discovered that Dyson was friends with the Mitchells' daughter on Facebook. He was then able to ask several eyewitnesses if they recognized the man. They did, and it resulted in Dyson's arrest yesterday. Dyson did not resist arrest and claims that he did not rob or murder anyone, but Filipino police obtained video footage of him pawning off the stolen goods in a pawn shop. They also said that he had a fascination with guns, and all nine victims were shot with the same pistol, linking the murders together. Ultimately, however, it was his Facebook profile that betrayed him. Quote, "He was fond of computers, and this gave him away," said Senior Superintendent Danilo Bautista. You want to see more on this story? Go to TechEye.net. Hey, Google makes it into the technology news headlines one more time. They have nabbed the patent to monitor your cursor movements. Yep. Google has been awarded a patent for displaying search results based on how you move your mouse cursor on the screen. While it sounds initially bizarre, Google's plans are to monitor the movements of the cursor, such as when a user hovers over a certain ad or link to read a tooltip, and then provide relevant search results and ads based on that behavior. It means that it does not require users to actually click the link to know that they were interested in it, opening a world of opportunity for even more focused ads, which are Google's main source of income. The patent entitled System and Method for Modulating Search Relevancy Using Pointer Activity Monitoring. It's numbered 7756887 and was filed on February 16th, 2005, but it was only this month that it was published and released to the public. It is also a continuation of a previous patent filed in December 2004. Whether or not this means Google is actively pursuing the idea remains to be seen, but it seems likely that this is just its intent. Google certainly has the resources and manpower to put it into action and can justify the costs involved with the potential revenue made through a more refined ad network. One potential problem that may arise with this technology, however, is privacy. Again, exactly how will Google monitor mouse movements? Currently, its statistics and analytics are based on actual clicks. To monitor the cursor would require potential invasion of privacy by stepping off the web itself and into the user's browser. It may avoid such problems by writing code into its search engine tooltips, which in turn, when it pops up, will send Google information that a tooltip has been used, which will let it know that the user has moused over it. If it does not take this or a similar approach, it may end up in more hot water over privacy concerns. Be aware. bees are the buzz and they're in the news. Beekeeping classes from Medina, Ohio to the suburbs of Washington, D.C. and New York are seeing an unexpected shift in enrollment. Numbers are way up as thousands of novices take up the hobby. And who are these new beekeepers? Increasingly, they're women. The surge has really been with younger urban women, explains longtime instructor Kim Flottam, who teaches beekeeping in Medina. Flottam estimates that there are about 100,000 backyard beekeepers across the United States. Exact numbers are hard to pin down, but subscriptions to the publication Bee Culture are on the rise. And when Flottam published a how-to book, An Absolute Beginner's Guide to Keeping Bees in Your Yard and Garden, 60,000 people snapped up copies. The book is aimed at making the hobby easier and using more lightweight equipment. Honey does have antimicrobial properties. Some hospitals are even using medicinal-grade honey as a topical ointment for burn patients. There's a renewed interest in the age-old claims about honey. 2 millennia ago, the Romans had declared honey to be the finest, most health-promoting liquid known to man. These claims are still abundant today, and with many people swearing by honey to alleviate allergies. With the report of the syndrome called colony collapse disorder, whole hives have been known to suddenly just die off. 50% of our bee colonies have been lost in the last 10 years, and it's a mystery to experts as to what's causing this phenomenon. Several hypotheses have been proposed as a cause, citing biotic factors such as varroa mites and insect diseases, environmental change-related stresses such as malnutrition and pesticides, or even genetically modified crops. And the latest idea is that cell phones can be affecting them, are ideas that are being explored, but none of these items have been sufficiently substantiated, and the common idea is that it's a combination of these factors that are all contributing to this deadly syndrome by weakening the bees' immune systems. There are almost 900 commercial beekeepers in the United States. These little insects are essential to our food supply and pollinate billions of dollars worth of fruits and vegetables every year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to help. It's handed out $6 million in emergency assistance just this summer to beekeepers who have lost their hives. Now these urban beekeepers are the new helpers in the encouragement of our bee population. Take a look at having your own apiary. It looks like a lot of fun, and you get some honey too. Hey you, stop daydreaming and pay attention. When your mind drifts, it's harder to remember what's going on before you stop paying attention. Now a new study has found that the effect is stronger when your mind drifts farther, to memories of an overseas vacation instead of a domestic trip, for example, or a memory in the more distant past. Psychologists have known for a while that context is important to remembering. If you leave the place where memory was made, its context, it will be harder for you to recall the memory. Previous studies had also found that thinking about something else, daydreaming or mind wandering, blocks access to memories of the recent past. Psychological scientists Peter F. Delaney and Lily Sahakian of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and Colleen M. Kelly and Carissa A. Zimmerman of Florida State University, wanted to know if the content of your daydreams affects your ability to access a recently acquired memory. For one experiment, each participant looked at a list of words as they appeared on a computer screen one at a time. Then they were told to think about either home, where they'd been that morning, or about their parents' house, where they hadn't been in several weeks. Next, the participant was shown a second list of words. At the end of the test, they had to recall as many of the words from the two lists as possible. Participants who had thought about the first place they'd been only a few hours before remembered more of the words from the first list than did the participants who had thought back several weeks. The same was true for memories about place, tested in a second experiment. Those who thought about a vacation within the U.S. remembered more words than those who thought about a vacation abroad. The study is published in Psychological Science, a journal of the Association for Psychological Science. One practical application of the research might be for people who want to forget about something. If there's something you don't feel like you're thinking about, you're better off remembering a more distant event than a close event, or try to put it out of your mind for a while, says Delaney. It can help you feel like you're in a different situation. Well, daydream away. Genetics is redrawing The marsupial family tree. New analysis traces group's origins to South America. The kangaroo's twisted marsupial family tree is now in order thanks to, you guessed it, jumping genes. Genetic evidence shows that a South American ancestor gave rise to all Australian marsupials, and that South American opossums were the earliest group to branch off from the six other marsupial clans. Distinctive for raising their live-born young in protective pouches, marsupials all trace back to a common ancestor that split off from the rest of the animals about 130 million years ago. But fossil and genetic evidence conflict about which marsupial species evolved first and where. Jumping genes provide new clues for solving the puzzle. These junk bits of DNA make copies of themselves to reinsert randomly in the genome. Half of the marsupial genome consists of jumping genes, so researchers have plenty to work with. Gene jumping is rare, and each jump is a unique event, unlikely to happen again. So if two species share a jumping gene, well, scientists can deduce that they inherited it from a common ancestor. Dr. Maria Nielsen and her colleagues in Germany looked at some similarities and differences in jumping genes in the seven main branches of marsupials. In the July PLOS Biology, the team presents a new marsupial family tree with slightly different familial relationships than other research had predicted. It's a different type of data, and it's much cleaner than fossil and genetic data, says evolutionary biologist David Pollack of the University of Colorado School of Medicine in Denver, who he was not involved in the research. According to the new tree, all Australian marsupials arose from a single South American ancestor. In addition, their data puts away the gray, short South American opossum on the earliest branch of the marsupial tree. There's also the potential for error in molecular studies, says mammalogist Ines Horowitz of the University of California, Los Angeles. But she says the study, quote, contributes new data, and that's always important, unquote. Next, Nielsen says she wants to use jumping genes to probe the relationships among Australian marsupials to see exactly how they're related.
fear till you all just disappear. Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash away.
Well, we can't let this day go by without the subject. From the quirky news, so from the Orange News Report, there's a man who claims aliens are pelting his home. A Bosnian man whose house has been hit 6 times by meteorites claims aliens are targeting him. The white-hot rocks have hammered Radi Vojelajic's house repeatedly since 2007, forcing him to reinforce the roof of his Kornji Lajiki home with steel girder, and I am sure I pronounced that completely wrong. Experts at Belgrade University have confirmed that all the rocks he has produced are meteorites, but Lajic believes their trajectory is no accident, claiming, quote, "I am obviously being targeted by aliens." Obviously. He continued, quote, "I don't know what I have done to annoy them, but there is no other explanation that makes sense. The chance of being hit by a meteorite is so small that getting hit 6 times has to be deliberate. If you rule out the possible, then the impossible must be true. I'm going to take this argument to my next philosophy professor." Lajic has had so many visitors to his house that he plans to erect a small museum in his back garden, and he can thank all those aliens pelting him with meteorites for the income that he accrues from this. Huh? What do you think about that? Aliens aren't all bad, are they, Lajic? Well, this has been Savage Science. Thank you to Dennis Baum and Hawk Studios for my intro, and Nick Polico for the rocking artwork on the Savage Science logo. Next week, we'll have a report on how blind people dream and a movie review on Inception. Have a great week, and keep your powder and your pants dry. Happy trails.